Back to Eric a little bit later on, but as I say, my guest is here now, because it is fair to say that although he might be too modest to admit it himself, though maybe not, Chris Hadfield is most definitely the most famous astronaut in the world right now as we speak, and has been for some time. During his time commanding the International Space Station, he became known to us all for his regular updates on Twitter and other social media, which chronicled life aboard the ISS and featured some stunning photos of the Earth beneath them, including a few pictures of Ireland, and memorably he even tweeted the caption, "Ask Gaelga." Now, he might have retired as an astronaut, of course he did there some months back, about a year ago, whatever, but his experience in space continues to inspire him and, of course, fascinate others. He's already released an autobiography last year, and now he's released another book featuring a selection of the photos that he took from the International Space Station. It's entitled You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. It's a beautiful coffee table book, perfect for Christmas. And I'm delighted to say Chris has just flown into Dublin on a normal airplane, unfortunately, and he joins me now. And by the way, before I even say hello to you, with the laughter in behind, I'm going to tell you what other things he's doing. This afternoon, he's going to be at Easton's signing the book at O'Connell Street. That's at 4:30 in the afternoon. Tomorrow morning, he's in Dubray Books in Grafton Street. All these Dublin addresses, of course. Dubray Books in Grafton Street at 11 o'clock. And then Easton's again tomorrow afternoon, but this time at the Dundrum Shopping Centre. And I'll give you those dates again later on. And 51552 if you want to send in a question to ask Chris or at Dave Fanning Show. So, Chris, I've got a question for you. Tell me about your fear of heights.
I think it's... good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
And just on the new book, my wife and my profits from proceeds from the book, I'll go to the Red Cross. So we very much appreciate folks buying it. And it's doing its number one in the UK.
It is number one in the UK, which is great.
So we're delighted. We've already written two checks to the Red Cross. So we're really pleased with the success of it. I do have a fear of heights. I think everyone should have a fear of heights. It'll keep you alive someday. It's a basic thing. But the real question, of course, is what do you do with such a fear? You know, do you let it keep you from life, or do you find some way to deal with it so that you could not only keep yourself alive, but also find some way to see this perspective that changes from getting up high?
Okay, what have you done with that fear in some ways? I mean, like, let's just go back. Everybody of an age can remember where they were in the third week of July in 1969 when the man walked on the moon for the first time. I mean, I remember I was in Carrarone, County Galway in the west of Ireland, and I was cycling at night looking up saying, so gosh, there really is a man on the moon, and his name is Armstrong. So just tell me, where were you at that age or whatever? You were 7, 8, or 9 or whatever.
It was, of course, July, as you say, and I was at my parents' summer cottage. They have a little simple cottage, no television or anything. We actually had to go to a neighbor's place to watch the moon landing, but same thing, riding my little banana seat bike at that time, looking up at the moon, thinking, that's impossible, things just happened. That's an amazing change in our capability, but more importantly, to see something impossible happen because of the application of human will was immensely motivating for a young person like myself. It was like permission to dream of doing something that at the time was impossible. Canada had no space agency or astronauts, but I decided that night to see if it was possible to turn myself into an astronaut.
Turn yourself into an astronaut. I mean, like, I could, but I won't necessarily. Because if I was to read even this back bit here, I would be exhausted. One of the world's most seasoned and accomplished astronauts, the author of the number one international bestseller, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, the top graduate of the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School in 1988 and U.S. Navy Test Pilot of the Year in 91, selected to be an astronaut in 92, Chief Capcom at NASA for 25 shuttle missions, and serves Director of Operations for NASA in Star City, Russia from 2001 to 2003. And I'm going to bring you up to date now. Chief of Robotics for the NASA Astronaut Office in Houston from 3 to 6, and Chief of International Space Station Operations for the NASA Astronaut Office from 2006 to 2008. Mother of God, and you recently served as Commander of the International Space Station, where while conducting a record-setting number of scientific experiments and overseeing an emergency spacewalk, he gained worldwide acclaim for his breathtaking photographs and educational videos about life in space, and of course a David Bowie cover, but we'll get to that in a second or two. Always like to travel, be it space or not. Is that the way it was with you?
My father was an airline pilot, so I've traveled ever since I was young. Seeing the world is important for truly getting a perspective for making decisions with your own life. And there's various ways to see the world, but travel's a good one. And one of the ideas behind this book, though, was to let people see the world for what it truly is, not someone else's opinion or a reporter standing in front of some particularly ravaged part of the world, but actually just see the world for what it looks like. And I took 45,000 pictures over my 3 space flights and tried to wean out the I don't know, 150 or so that best showed the whole world in the book, so that then you could think, when you think Auckland, or when you think Crimea, or when you think whatever, San Francisco, what is that, what's it actually all look like when you put it in the same context and start thinking of the whole world as one connected, continuous place?
Okay, because I'm just looking at the subtitle of the book. Like, it's photos from the International Space Station. You are here around the world in 92 minutes. Were you seeing like a sunrise and a sunset every 92 minutes?
Well, half of that, of course, every 46. So you see either a sunrise or a sunset. Yeah, every time you come around. So that means you go around the world 16 times a day. So I've been around the world 2,593 times, and that. Speed of it. You cross Ireland in seconds, you know, from side to side at 8 kilometers a second. So you can't soak it up with your eyes. You try, but, you know, you're just looking all the way from Cork and you see Dublin, you look up to Belfast and the Inishowen and the whole thing just in a glance. And if you don't grab a camera and take a picture, then the next time around it may be cloudy and you miss the whole thing. And so I took all those photographs and then this past winter, I realized I hadn't even seen most of them because there wasn't time while I was on the spaceship. And so I went through them during the winter, all 45,000, and tried to winnow it down to a decent number. And I'm really delighted to see the reaction.
Yeah, and the book
helps show people of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I presume you had a good camera.
NASA puts good cameras on board.
In fact, now that I think about it, don't you credit your parents at the beginning of the book for giving you the first camera?
That's right. Yeah, my mom and dad, Roger and Eleanor, they gave me my very first camera. Not much of a camera, a little Instamatic 110, but it was my start. And then for our wedding, they gave us a nice camera. But NASA, of course, trained me. I helped make 2 IMAX movies, so I trained as an IMAX cameraman and Hasselblad's the big heavy 70 millimeter and then all the 35 millimeter and digital. So I did lots and lots of camera training over the years, and they have decent cameras. But the cameras don't last up there at all because there's so much radiation. They actually, those high energy particles from the universe damage the sensors in the camera, and you can see you can see black spots in your pictures getting worse and worse. So we have to constantly replace the cameras up there just because of the radiation from all the suns of the universe.
And is this something you found when you were up there that you might have known beforehand, in the same way as when you're out sort of in space, like just tied on with the thing?
that's the technical term
that thing that, like, you know, your glasses were kind of steaming up and you suddenly had to well, that's something you found only by doing it, and pretty scary.
Well, We train more than anybody ever knows, you know, the detail and the excruciating level of visualization, and then repetition over and over and over again for years and years and years, trying so that when you do get up there, as you say, it may be not quite exactly what you expected, but hopefully something that you've done in one of the simulators has given you a workaround or a skill or a calm. And when you talk about the fear of heights, it's the same thing. It's not a fear is easy, right? Fear is your fundamental reaction to not knowing what to do.
Yeah.
But when you really break it down to, okay, I can see that this is a fearful thing, but what's the actual danger? What's the real thing here? Of course, falling doesn't kill you. It's hitting the ground. So if you can keep from hitting the ground, then you're okay. And that's why, you know, a bungee is different than just falling off a bridge, or being strapped to something, or being supported by wings, or whatever it is that gives you solace that you're not going to hit the ground. You no longer need to be fearful. And it works for everything, including flying a rocket ship or doing a spacewalk.
Right, okay. Well, now, just a couple of texts here. 51552. Chris Hadfield is my top hero, a person I would love to meet. You can today or tomorrow if you're in Dublin. A true gentleman. Can't wait to get his book, Inspiring Amongst All the Negative Stuff. And that comes in from a granny.
Oh, that's lovely.
Can you tell Chris that I loved his book and I think he's amazing, inspiring, effing cool. I'll have to leave out some of those letters there. An effing cool person.
Fantastic.
He never gave up. Yeah, fantastic, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. He never gave up and always followed his dreams. Only wish I'd half his courage, from Audrey. Courage?
That's lovely. Well,
is it courage?
Some things that we're taking a risk for. I mean, that's you can spend your whole life huddled at home with a pillow over your head, but you're still going to die eventually. So the real question is, what in life is worth taking a risk for? I am not a thrill seeker at all. I'm not interested in having adrenaline pump into my veins so that I can deal with something I have no control over. That doesn't thrill me at all. I'm much more interested in saying, we don't understand much about the rest of the universe. To start to explore it in person, to be one of the early folks to be leaving Earth to try and figure out everything beyond us. Yeah. You know, that to me, that's interesting. I was a test pilot for many years, trying to make airplanes safer. We take them for granted. This morning I flew here from London, and you hardly even think about the incredible thing that's happening around you to get into that aluminum tube and go whistling across the water here. But a lot of people lost their lives making those airplanes safe, the test pilots and the original engineers and things. And some things are worth taking a risk for. And then how do you prepare for the risk is the real key to me. And how do you enjoy the process of taking those risks, not just because it excites you, but because like an exam that has a really complex answer where you have worked on it in advance enough that you can figure this thing out and solve it in a way that nobody has before. To me, that is fascinating and the real challenge of life. Whether that's courage or not, I'm not sure, but it's what I think is the real key to enjoying what's going on around you.
Well, whatever about risk-taking, without a doubt, and the evidence shows right across the board that you are a fierce explorer of the universe, to say the least, and you've been given the opportunity and you've taken it and grabbed it with both hands. Whether you like it or not now, and I get the impression, I hope you do like it in some ways, you are the go-to guy. I mean, you're the most famous astronaut in the world. Are you okay with that? And all that that means, celebrity endorsements and that. In fact, like bloody Major Tom, the people want to know what shirts you wear.
Right. Well, I mean, it depends. When you say celebrity, of course, it's just based on the word celebrated. And it depends what you're being celebrated for. If it's because of some horrible digression, public thing you've had and now everybody's fascinated, or if it's a real transient thing. But in my case, I wasn't setting out to be celebrated. I worked 21 years in the astronaut office, and it's most of the time away from home. And I spent a couple winters in Russia doing nothing but learning orbital mechanics in Russian with a Russian professor one-on-one, you know, slogging for years and years, but in order to build up the capability to do something that's right on the edge of human possibility. Yeah. And if people want to celebrate along with that, because this book is really a celebration of that. This is what you can see if you push yourself to that level. This is something that is otherwise unknown and invisible to us. And to be able to see it, to me, is the reward. But it's not just the images, of course. The entire experience to me was so immensely rewarding. And the fact that now with social media from the space station, I could share that directly with millions of people. And if folks want to celebrate that I think it's terrific. I'm delighted that they find it interesting and not just I.
Yeah, indeed, because like, I mean, this is what the book is here in terms of just, you know, like the pictures that are in it, and they're more than just pictures, they completely come to life. It really is a kind of a vertical, virtual orbit of the Earth.
Yeah, I was thinking, how do I choose from 45,000 pictures? Yeah. I mean, so I was talking with my wife, Helena, and we set a guideline that was, she said, picture that one of your friends is on the spaceship with you at the window. What would you want to show them?
Yeah.
You know, what parts of the world would you tug on their sleeve and say, hey, look at that? And what would you say to them out loud? And I've been talking to a lot of kids that have been lining up for autographs and saying, don't just look at this as a picture book. Imagine that it's you on board a spaceship looking at our world, because that's where every single one of these pictures was taken. See our world from a spaceship. It's a really hard-wrought perspective. And I think the pictures maybe gain the significance that I intended.
Okay, but let's see if it gives us something else as well, because it's not just the magnificence of kind of newly uncovered landscapes and the history and consequences of human settlement and all that stuff you get, but does it actually give us a glimpse in any way at all into the future of our species? Should I be getting that much from this book in terms of, I don't know, an idea for the future?
Well, to some degree, yes, because some of the pictures for sure show the immensity of the planet and the age of the planet. The planet's been here, you know, by our best estimates, 4.5 billion years. And that, the patience of that, like some enormous Leviathan thing that's been here longer than anybody can imagine, there is a peace and a comfort in that. The age of it, and also the self-healing nature of it. You see the horrific volcanic scars and asteroid impacts and things that it's taken in the past. But you also see the transient damage we're doing right now, largely which affects ourselves, of course. If the sea level on the Earth rises a half a meter, the world is going to be okay, but it will immensely affect human life and a lot of natural life on the world. The constant evolution of how habitable the world is will change somewhat. And we, however you want to measure it, you know, are changing the climate to some degree, and we need to not panic about it. We need to actually look at the world as a whole, look at our options, look at what it is we're doing that is causing change, what options we truly have for maintaining our standard of living and taking care of each other. But you have to see the world globally in order to make the right decisions. All the local decisions are the ones that have sort of dug us into where we are.
Okay, but like this fresh look that we have, if you like, at our planet, you got the front seat, no question about it. But now you're giving us the next best thing. But do you see more than us here? I mean, like the detail and the importance was, I presumed, was helped by your great knowledge in the past of geology and geography and meteorology and all the rest of it. But are we a little bit kind of, you know, like...
Well, it depends how long you want to look at the
photograph. Not as brainy as you.
No, well, there's a picture in there. I tried to write the stuff I would tell you. The picture in there of San Francisco Bay, to me, I could look at that picture for an hour. Yeah. There is ancient geology. You can see the San Andreas Fault. You can see this weird rift in the ocean. You can see all of the human habitation on top of the tectonic forces that are ripping that part of California and subducting them down into the ocean. Where the salt is generated in the southern end of the bay that fought the polar vortex and all of the salt on the roads in Canada last year. It's all there in one glimpse of the world. And to me, it's hugely instructional and informative. And also just the delight of looking at the world.
Yeah.
But I, you know, NASA geologists and geographers and oceanographers and meteorologists, they all talk to us in great detail. And I studied geology before. And I just did my best to take the things that I know and make little annotations in every picture.
Indeed.
Exactly. If you and I had been there together, what would I? What
well,
would
as somebody said, if
world,
somebody looking out the window, and you're told,
this
as your
what,
wife said,
sees,
just
yeah.
Let's take a look at two sort of topical points about all this sort of thing. By the way, we are talking to Chris Hadfield, and the book itself is called "You Are Here: Around the World in 92 Minutes." Signing is in three places: two today and one tomorrow. Or maybe no, sorry, one today and two tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'll give you those in a few minutes' time. They're all in Dublin. And here's a question here at 51552: does Chris think that space tourism is imminent? And if it is it a good idea? That comes in from Jimmy.
It depends on your own personal definition of imminent, I guess. It's closer than it's ever been, but it's still very difficult. And tourism is something being able to buy a ticket and go do something as a passenger, fundamentally, where you don't have to be the explorer, you don't have to be expert, you can go along. And that's what Richard Branson is trying to make possible, where you won't go around the world, you just go straight up, get just to the bottom, just like tickle the bottom edge of space, have a look at the curvature of the Earth, spend a few minutes weightless, and then fall back down again. It's a small first step, but it's the first step. But a month ago, one of the test pilots died testing that air vehicle. It's not ready for passengers yet. That's no different than saying in 1914, 100 years ago, are we ready for aviation tourism? Can there be an air traveler?
Right,
and we
indeed.
Really weren't.
Yeah,
you know, those planes crashed all the times back then. And it took a huge amount of investment and trial and error and test pilots until eventually now you just get on Ryanair and go, and all you're really worried about is how cramped the seats are. You're not thinking about, you know, the safety of the vehicle anymore. And Richard Branson is trying to push that back right now. So imminent, probably not. Soon, yes. But it won't be going to Mars anytime soon.
I was just
going
to ask. Okay, a manned mission
problem.
To Mars is announced tomorrow, and they want Chris to go. Does Chris say yes?
Chris says, on what? What spaceship?
Well, it's something that will get you there safely. It won't get you back, by the way.
But astronauts don't go for rides. We are not space tourists. We help design the vehicles. We help make the vehicles work. I help design the cockpit of the space shuttle, and I help design procedures for flying the Russian Soyuz spaceship. We are intimately involved in making spaceflight possible. So if someone said, hey, we're going to Mars, I would say, okay, well, what in? And how am I going to work on it so that I have a reasonable shot at getting there? Because I don't want to die 30 days out from the Earth on the way to Mars because we didn't get it right. And I don't think anybody does.
Imagine assuming that you do see plans and you can look into the future in some way and it says, yeah, this is pretty safe. This is great. This is going to happen. Would you do it?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. But that caveat is that there lies the rub right there for sure.
Can I use that caveat as well? Okay, back in June 92, actually, there were 5,500 applicants for what you went for at the time. Four were chosen. Why were you chosen?
That was the worst process of my life. I talk about fear of heights. I sent in my application in January and they didn't choose us.
Application for what exactly?
To become an astronaut.
To become an astronaut. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And Canada had never done it. Like they stuck want ads in the papers across the country, said wanted astronauts. And that's where the 5,000, whatever, 300 people applied. And then it was so slow. There was no internet. Everything was, you know, by mail. And it just took forever. And I had this gnawing fear in the pit of my stomach for months at a time until finally they did choose four of us from the 5,300. I think a large part of it was how I'd been turning myself into an astronaut since I was nine. I'd gotten various university degrees in technical fields. I'd learned to fly. I'd learned to scuba dive, learned to speak other languages, became a pilot. Then I was in the Air Force, became a fighter pilot, intercepting Soviet bombers during the Cold War off the coast of Canada, and then went to test pilot school and became a test pilot, and on exchange with the U.S. as a test pilot with the U.S. Navy, did a whole variety of tests, and went back to university and got another degree. It was all of that kind of, I was just channeling Neil Armstrong. I was like, okay, what did Neil do? What did Alexei Leonov do? What type of men were they by the time they got selected? And I'm going to try and turn myself into one of those. And the beauty of it is I loved every step along the way. And if someone had said, I'm sorry, you're not going to be an astronaut, that part of me would have been disappointed. But all the things I'd done to that point had been extremely productive, and I'd set myself up for a life that I was, we had all sorts of backup plans, be a test pilot, go to university, teach test flying, all sorts of subsets of chasing my dreams turned out to be what I really like the taste of it all. So it's kind of an interesting pattern to think about in life in general.
Okay, but by the way, two things you said there. Number one is just the thing about teaching. Is that what you're doing now? Are you in the University of Waterloo? Did you take up that?
I do. I teach part-time at the University of Waterloo in where I did some graduate work there as well. But we also do a thing with schools across Canada. I started it years ago with the Canadian Space Agency called On the Lunch Pad, just kind of an odd pun, but I was sitting at my desk one day using my computer, looking at cat videos or something at lunchtime, and I thought, why am I not, well, you have Skype, why am I not just talking to students who are eating their lunch somewhere? And so I started just tying in with classrooms and been doing it ever since. And it's great. All I'd basically do is just answer kids' questions so that they can maybe make a slightly more informed set of choices.
On that point,
great.
Which is better, airline food or space shuttle food?
depends on the airline. Space shuttle food is all kind of room temperature stored, so everything has to be able to sit on the shelf forever. It's like military rations.
Right.
It's all right. It's canned food, tinned food, rehydrated food, but it's not bad, and we have a lot of dietitians. I think, actually, give it a choice, I would take space food over airline food.
Okay. By the way, you did mention about like every step of the way. The journey was always fantastic, regardless of whether the outcome happens or not, because it's all about the journey in terms of your career and your life and what you've done. So, but just on the walking bit, just your first spacewalk, I kind of vaguely alluded to it earlier on in terms of the glasses, etc. It was pretty dramatic, wasn't it?
Spacewalks are, by definition,
that's
dramatic.
That's a stupid thing for me to say.
They are dramatic.
Spacewalk, like, it was pretty dramatic, wasn't it? Like, unusually, your spacewalk is more dramatic than mine. But seriously, it was pretty bizarre, wasn't it?
The moment that you're locked inside this tiny airlock, two of you, head to toe, because there's not room for you both to be facing the same way. I was lead spacewalker on my first spacewalk, which is really unusual. Kind of all the responsibility on my shoulders. Open up the hatch, grab the sides of the hatch. And it's ridiculous because the engineers who design hatches make them round because that's good for a pressure vessel, right? Mm-hmm. But the engineers who design spacesuits make them square because that's the nice pattern for a backpack. Mm-hmm. So you are literally this square peg, trying to come out the round hole. So and it's easy to get messed up and get all tangled, and you're attached through, what did you call it, that thing you're attached with?
Yeah, a thing. It's called a thing.
So you don't want to get your thing wrapped around your legs as you're pulling yourself out of the airlock. So your mind is full of all those little minute details, but you pull yourself out into space, and it is overwhelmingly beautiful. It's imagine if you or I were sitting here right now and suddenly Angel Falls appeared right next to us, or some vast fireworks display, or a herd of wildebeest charging right here. Both of us would be just dumbfounded with the sudden, instantaneous visual change of what was happening next to us. And it's like that when you pull yourself out into space. The world is so much more evocatively beautiful than I ever expected. The textures of it are right there next to you, and it's enormous, and it's pouring by, and you're in the universe looking at it by yourself, just through your visor. So it is an incredible human experience to be out on a spacewalk. And as you mentioned, I was blinded during my first one. There was some contamination in the suit that got into one eye, and then it teared up so badly, and the tears don't drain without gravity, so the tear ball got so big on, and you can't wipe it off, so it got so big on my left eye that it eventually flowed across the bridge of my nose and contaminated my other eye, and I was blind in both eyes for about a half hour, which is not what I was expecting to happen. But I could still, you know, fear. What do? Do you panic? Do you?
Yeah.
But I was like, I can still talk. I can still hear. I can still think. I'm holding on to a spaceship. Nothing is actually happening except I can't see. So I'm not dead. I'm just see if I can see. If I can't see, I'm out there not alone. There's another guy out there with me. He can come and help drag me in like a balloon and stuff me into the airlock again, and then we'll deal with my eyes later. And hopefully I'll be able to see again. But it's not the end of the world. And so we just dealt with it. And fortunately, my eyes teared enough, and they evaporated, the tears evaporated, that it diluted it enough I could start to see after a while.
Do you know, just what you're describing there, if I'm trying to picture it, I genuinely do see George Clooney and Sandra Bullock in Gravity, because this is what you, and even the third guy as well, who was there. And like,
he didn't do a good job.
He didn't really.
He was an extra. He was crewman number three.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Okay, well, the point about it is, just on that note, did Gravity get it right, or as right as rain, or as possible?
What's the opposite of as right as rain?
Completely and absolutely 100% wrong.
Yeah, the visuals were pretty good. The visuals were very compelling,
right.
But the characters that they portrayed, when we select from a huge number of people to choose those few astronauts.
So you're not going to pick Sandra Bullock and George Clooney?
Well, I know which one I'd pick over the other, but given the amount of training we do together, just their characters were very flawed, and they weren't prepared. And then the storyline was so, yeah. I mean, they changed the laws of physics and most of the things that happened, there's just no way it could happen physically. And so it was that part just, I was the worst guy in the world to watch that movie. Though,
yeah, so. I suppose, yeah, yeah. I suppose you bore the pants off everybody in the cinema. That wouldn't happen. That's not real. Shut up. Anyway, just as a matter of interest, you just mentioned earlier on, of the three kids, in the David Bowie thing that you did, and if people don't know about it, they should check it up, because you're with 50 other or 30 other million people who've already watched it, which is Space Oddity. That you say. But do you bring a guitar with you on every single space adventure?
Everywhere I go in really?
Okay,
my whole
so
life,
he
I
sings
bring
Space
guitar,
Oddity, and it's all there. I'm going to give you a bit of this when you leave the studio later on, but it's all there to be seen, etc. But I see the film that's with it. It's fantastic, the whole thing, and all the weightlessness and all the outside stuff, etc. But it's directed by, or it's put together by, a certain somebody with the same surname as you. Would that be your son, by any chance?
Yeah, Evan, in fact. It was his idea. Well, he heard a huge clamoring on the internet. I recorded a Christmas carol that my brother and I had written.
Yeah.
As soon as people on social media heard there was a musician on board the space station recording music, then there was this steady clamor to do a cover of Space Oddity, which was bizarre to me, because why would I cover David Bowie? Nobody covers David Bowie. And also, Oddities, if you listen to the words, the astronaut dies at the end.
It's not a very
happy
story.
Very good song.
Well, you can
always
just do Ashes to Ashes, which is kind of the Tom part two.
But my son convinced me. I got him to rewrite the words so that I lived at the end. And the version that came out was far better than I thought it was going to be. And a musician named M. Griner, who's performed over here for it as well, she put in the piano work underneath, and then my son said, "Dad, it has to be video. You're in space. It can't just be audio."
Yeah, right.
And so I was like, "Ah, yes, I'm busy, but okay, you're right." So one Saturday, I floated around singing it, and then he put that video together with a friend of his in the East Coast of Canada named Andrew Tidby, and we were going to release it early, but then we had to do an emergency spacewalk on the station and it ended up getting released the day before I came home, not through some big master plan, just that was as quick as we got it done. Like, you got a deadline, got to get it done. And the first person I met when I came back to Earth, when our capsule had, it was a little Russian spaceship, had slammed into the Earth and rolled to a stop, all charred there on the fields of Kazakhstan. And a Russian safety technician comes and cranks open the hatch and looks in, and he dragged our the Russian out first, and then Tom Marshburn in the right seat. Then he looked in at me and said, "Chris, привет, я видел твой клип, прекрасно, мой друг," which means, "Hey, Chris. Hey, I saw your video. It was great." That's the first human being that welcomed me back to Earth.
And he, David Bowie gave a thumbs up as well. Yeah, even though it was taken off for a while, he put it back on up there.
Well, he was all for it.
But there's no jurisdiction on like, you know, royalties.
But it's his intellectual property. You know, he wrote that song. And then all his legal team, of course, he said it was the most poignant version of the song
but
ever.
But you probably recorded it in about 300 countries.
Poignant's a good word, right?
Poignant's a great word. Yeah, I love that word.
We recorded it over top of every country. And we're kind of setting legal precedent to some degree over intellectual property when you're not on Earth. So we wanted to get it right. And I just want to say, there was sort of a reaction as if his people had been obtuse or mean or something. Not at all. No. Everyone was just trying to do it legal and right.
Well, I'm going to play a bit of that supportive. A little bit later on. But just your daughter then, Kristen, she is currently in or just finishing Trinity College Dublin?
She finished her whole training here. She did all the work. She did a whole thing in looking at growing up Irish and the kids that have split families and step families and such, and what impact that has from a child's point of view. She just finished all of her thesis. She's got it all written and submitted and accepted. She has to come back just to do the oral defense, the viva, and she'll be back next month, actually, and then she'll have completed it. And she loved her time in Dublin. She's working in Chicago right now, she is missing being here.
And was any celebrity aspect to her life? Do you know who my dad is?
We've always in the family very much encouraged not to identify yourself by who somebody else is. You know, be yourself and be respected for who you are. But of course, it's hard to avoid when the last name gets to a level of notoriety that it is, that people ask immediately. But she's extremely competent and confident and self-assured and has done a great job here, and I'm hugely proud of her.
The places that you've looked at from space and how you look down, is there any place you look at that? I mean, you mentioned San Francisco there early on. I presume you'd been to San Francisco before. Was there anywhere you looked and said, I am going to visit that place? That looks so amazing from where I am.
Lots of places. Some places you want to visit, but wouldn't be nice. Like the Sahara is fascinating. The empty quarter of the Arabian Peninsula is amazing to look at, but I'm sure it's a wicked place to walk around. New Zealand really attracts me. I've never been. My wife and I have just been a little bit to Australia, but New Zealand is so long and from the mountains and the fjords in the south all the way up to the volcanoes of the north and the big wine country. So I was on the space station looking down at the north end of the South Island, and there's this beautiful big broad valley, and you could actually see where the vineyards are sitting on the hillsides there and the river flowing through and the agriculture and the big volcano in the north, and I thought, I can see myself sitting right there with my feet up trying that wine and spending a month in that place. So there's a few places of the world that just kind of it's like they have a finger crooked at you saying, you ought to come have a look at this a little closer. It's even better than it looks from space.
And are there any places like that, your perceptions of any countries, did they change since seeing them from space?
A lot of the world, you just sort of hear about theoretically.
Yeah.
You know, if someone says some name of some big country or city in some country in Africa that, I'd be hard-pressed to be sure that I'm even pointing out the right country in Africa. I don't know the whole world intimately. But the reason I mention it is when you see that city and you look at it, at first it's just you don't think about it, it's just some blob. But you realize when you look at the city just how exactly the same as it is to the cities that you do know.
Yeah.
And that's the most significant part of it, I think, is when you look down a place like Dublin or like Winnipeg or like Vancouver or Toronto or places I'm really familiar with, Houston where I lived 21 years or Moscow. And then you look at this city in a place where you're not exactly sure of the city or even the country, but obviously the people there are the same. They've developed civilization. They've got the downtown and the outskirts and the suburbs and the railway and the highways and the river flowing through it and the agriculture. It's all the same for all of us. And that's, to me, the most important part is the unanimity And the commonness of the human experience.
Well, Chris, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for dropping into us on the programme this morning. Just a few here. Well, Chris sounds remarkably like Kevin Spacey, pardon the pun as well. Yeah, okay, fair enough. I would listen to The Commander all day. A book is on my wish list now, so it is. Thanks. It doesn't say Commander on the cover here, but we know you are. You're a lot of things, by the way. I only mentioned half of it earlier on. Chris Hadfield, it is, author of the international bestseller An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. It's called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes, the perfect coffee table book to last for years.
My wife says, makes a nice Christmas gift.
It makes a nice Christmas gift. That's the point.
And our money goes to the Red Cross.
Indeed. So and your money goes to the Red Cross. And it's number one bestseller in England and now as we speak, or in the UK. So before we go to the news, just to remind people again that you will be here today in Dublin signing books. This afternoon at 4:30 p.m. it's Easons O'Connell Street. Tomorrow morning it's Dubray Books in Grafton Street. That's at 11 o'clock. And then tomorrow afternoon, 3 o'clock, Dundrum Shopping Centre, Easons again. Chris, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much, Steve, for dropping in. And may the road rise with you and every other thing that goes in front of you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much.
Good luck. See you. Take it easy.
Live across Ireland.